Redbox Media Programming is brought to you by Jack Kane Ford. Find your next Ford Tough vehicle at caneford.com. Woodhill Community Center. Have a hand in the heart of the city. Support their mission with your donations at woodhillcommunitycenter.org. Toyota on Nicholasville Superstore. Online consultants are standing by right now to help you find your next Toyota. Visit toyotaonnicholasville.com. Lexus of Lexington, home of the best-selling Lexus IS. Find yours today at lexusoflexington.com.
This is Chuck Coughlin on Setting the Record Straight, coming to you on the website, redboxmedia.com. I'm talking today about Jordan Peterson, the phenomenal Jordan Peterson phenomenon. Maybe you know who he is, maybe you don't. If you're a young man, a college-age man, you probably do. If you're a middle-aged or older man or woman, you might not. But he's hard to miss. As I speak to you, I'm looking at my screen on my computer at the website Amazon.com, at the page Amazon Charts of the Most Read and Most Sold Books, the top 20 books of the week, and it's always up to date because it's constantly updated by their sales. Jordan Peterson's book, 12 Rules for Life, An Antidote to Chaos, has been on that list for 12 weeks in the number one position today. It's been there quite a while. If you look at his 12 Rules for Life, it's predicated on what is very much Christian belief, that man is fallen, man is sinful, and only transcendental absolute values keep him from descending into chaos. And he's considered a rebel, not as a religious leader, but as a psychologist. He's a psychologist at the University of Toronto. And many call him one of the most important public intellectuals of the day. He should be well known. He's having an enormous influence on college campuses in Canada and in the United States. He's a professor at the University of Toronto and has a deep knowledge not only of psychology, he's been a clinical psychologist for about 40 years. But he has a deep knowledge of history and a deep knowledge of anthropology, two disciplines that are often the principal sources of these podcasts of Setting the Record Straight. I'm a historical apologist. And the true history of the last 2,000 years is actually little known. A lot of it's just ignored, not mentioned, or it's distorted, like the story of Galileo, very distorted, story that most people accept. They're negative myths. To make something more simple than it really is, we could say there's two sides in this argument. One side is the modern idea, which modern, since Jean-Jacques Rousseau in the 1700s, came up with the idea of the noble savage, that if man is left alone in the primitive state, he's noble, he's moral, he's virtuous. And it's culture, including organized religion and organized government, that has debased man and makes him capable of the heinous acts of inhumanity and vile behavior that characterized the 20th century under the communists and under the National Socialists in Germany, the Nazis. I think he does make the mistake in considering the Nazis right wing, because if anyone was ever left-wing or the National Socialist, let's think about the noble savage for a minute. The idea that man is basically good. There is no original sin. He's born and inherited goodness. I did a podcast called Lust for the Mud that describes this in fully. Nostalgie de la boue, Rousseau called it. A nostalgia for the mud. Try saying it once. Nostalgie de la boue. What a phrase. It's an atavistic desire that's in most people to return to our wild and primitive self and be under the control of our basic impulses. That led to the French Revolution, that led to World War II, that led to look at the communists in China, Russia, Cuba, other places, with horrendous results, unprecedented in humanity. The other concept is the concept that man is basically fallen, is sinful, and this is the side that Peterson is endorsing. The young people, not being properly churched, find this refreshingly, obviously true. And they're listening to him, going to his lectures, buying his books, honoring him. His YouTubes have millions of hits, many of them. Take a look. Jordan Peterson. And he doesn't claim to be a Christian, but he certainly appears to be when you read his books and you listen to him. I mean, he may be a closet Catholic. He frequently praises the Catholic Church, finds much to praise in it. There's an obvious affection there. Who knows what more? A question came from one of the many audiences. He said, "Are you a Catholic?" He said, "No, not exactly. But what really scares me, really frightens me, is it seems to be true." On another occasion, he ended a lecture that I watched on YouTube. He's very much a proponent, especially to young people, of taking ownership and control of the evil within each of us, of the fallenness within each of us. Take responsibility for it. What did he say to the young people? It's time to pick up your cross and follow Christ up the hill. Maybe he's really a front porch Catholic, just afraid to cross the threshold and to lose his tenured position at the University of Toronto. Who knows? And he might well, because he's come under the attention and censorship of the government for his viewpoints. And he's created a cause célèbre about that, but I'll discuss that in another podcast or look it up yourself. He's ignited a huge argument, a continent-wide argument. It's about a bill in the Canadian Parliament that passed about compelled speech. C-16, requiring the use of gender-neutral pronouns. Gender-neutral pronouns, like not he and she, but for transgender people, Z-E. You spell that Z-E, Z. Hey, Z, come here. In Canada, you're compelled to do that by a federal law. And he resists, and he's been censured for this. He's been punished for it, making him only more famous or infamous, depending on what you believe. To give you a feeling for Peterson, I'm going to give you a few quotes from his lectures and the books. And what he tells young people, they have to stand up and take responsibility. He said, before you go out to change the world, clean up your daggum room. In other words, begin with making yourself orderly in small ways. And only then are you ready to address bigger issues or less small ones. What he said about that is, weak and miserable as I am, I can still stand up to the terrible tragedy of life and prevail. Even Buddha said, his first sentence, life is pain. One of the things that causes that pain is the evil of Adam's sin, our inherited sin. Peterson says evil is the force that believes its knowledge is complete. Evil is the force that believes its knowledge is complete. In other words, intellectual arrogance, falling in love, the intellect falls in love with its own product. He often points out that the Catholic Church has been opposing that for centuries and centuries. He says this, the motivation that drives the commission of the worst human atrocities is an inevitable social consequence of the refusal of the self-conscious individual to make the sacrifices appropriate to establishing a harmonious life and their consequent degradation to a kind of murderous and resentment-filled rage propagating endlessly through its variations in society until everything comes to an end. Is he a pessimist? No, he's just skeptical. He believes there is a way to handle it. He knows about lies. He says when you tell a lie often enough, you become unable to distinguish it from the truth. If you tell enough lies often enough, the truth will become entirely hidden from you, and then you're in hell. A truly religious person tries to change himself or herself, which is more difficult and less grand a task. Ideologues assume that the problems of the world are someone else's fault. They assume that the broad-scale systemic change is a prerequisite to utopia. A truly religious person tries to change himself or herself, which is more difficult and less grand a task. He says, if religion was the opium of the masses, then communism was the methamphetamine of the masses. He says the proper functioning of the state is dependent on the proper functioning of the individual rather than the reverse. And the proper mode of the individual being that's redemptive is truth. Truth is the antidote to the suffering that emerges from the fall of man in the story of Adam and Eve. He reflects a lot on Adam and Eve in the Genesis. He said, when you know that the snake is in you, that's wisdom. When Adam and Eve realize they're naked, is that same moment they realize the difference between what's good and evil. What's the relationship between consciousness, knowledge of nakedness, and knowledge of good and evil? And they also developed the knowledge of death. So there's a deep knowledge of vulnerability, and they get embarrassed about that, and they cover themselves up. So that's culture. So it's a very profound shock when they come to recognize they're naked. It even causes Adam to run and hide from God. Then they develop the knowledge of good and evil. This is about how human beings have this peculiar capacity that no other creatures have. I know how I can be hurt because I'm aware of my own limitations, painfully aware. Now I know you can be hurt, and I can take advantage of that. That's how evil enters the world. It gives people another attribute of divinity, knowing the difference between good and evil. The snake becomes the adversary of being. There's the snake that bites you in the jungle. Then there's the snake that lives in your enemy. And then there's the snake that lives in your family. And then there's the snake that lives in you. And that snake that's in you, it's a psychological phenomena. It's equivalent to transcendent evil itself, the thing that inhabits every person. It's associated with the knowledge of our vulnerability that gives us this constant capacity for evil. There's an idea of free will associated with it too. In order for there to be being, there has to be a limitation. In order for there to be good, there has to be the possibility of evil. I think the right path is to exist such that the possibility of evil remains open, but you choose the good. I think that evil is human, and I think it's understandable. There's a difference between evil and tragedy. Tragedy does seem to be built into the structure of the world, but human beings seem to be equipped to deal with tragedy, but we're not equipped to deal with malevolence. That destroys people. I think that metaphysically speaking, the world is structured such that humans have a choice between good and evil. The notion that every single human being, regardless of their peculiarities and their strangeness and sins and crimes and all of that, has something divine in them that needs to be regarded with respect, plays an integral role, at least an analogous role, in the creation of a habitable order out of chaos. It's a magnificent, remarkable, and crazy idea. The notion that everyone is equal before God. Such a strange idea. And myself, Chuck Coughlin, want to add, yes, a very Christian idea, a very Catholic idea. He says, human beings are made in God's image. That's actually the cornerstone of our legal system. Our body of laws has that metaphysical presupposition, without which the laws fall apart. And that's starting to happen. It really is. It's the postmodern critique of law. The law schools are overrun by postmodernists who are undermining the structure of Western law as fast as they possibly can. They don't buy any of this, so they're much more likely to think of the law as a casual pragmatic tool that is to be manipulated for the purposes of bringing forth a utopia, the leftist progressive utopia. It's a really, really, really bad idea. It's very strange to me that we go off a track when that metaphysical foundation starts to get rattled. Jordan Peterson is very, very perceptive about totalitarianism and how close to it we are even now. How political correctness is the first step toward it. And you're almost already there. It's a house of cards. That's one impressive thing about the thinking of Peterson. He sees it just as I'm starting to see it. The more I study history, the more I study anthropology. We're more than just vulnerable. We're fragile. Our great edifice of Catholic doom, of Christendom, of our culture. The word culture contains as its kernel cult, the religion. Our culture's kernel religion is Catholicism. The mother of our culture is fragile. Our great miraculous society is a house of cards. Our culture is large, beautiful, and orderly in many of its aspects. But it's fragile and vulnerable and naked like Adam and Eve. Very small things can bring it down suddenly and without warning. Like one small card at the bottom of the house removed and it topples. The history of the world contains very few things as miraculous and fine as the Christian world. Peterson well understands this, and he turns his attention to the totalitarian states. Listen to what he has to say about that, about communism, for example. Peterson says, "One thing that characterized the communist state was that no one got to say anything they really believed, ever. That's because 1 in 3 people were informers. That was a lovely society, and it only killed about 30 million people between 1919 and 1959. That's what happens when the archetypal structure of society gets tilted badly. And people forget they have a responsibility to fulfill as citizens who are awake and capable of stating the truth. The archetype shifts so there's nothing left to the Great Father, except for the tyrant. Like it or not, your existence is grounded in faith." One of Peterson's definitions of evil is this: evil is the conscious desire to produce suffering where suffering is not necessary. Now, if you're a deep Catholic, this is not new stuff to you. But it is new to our secular world, to our secular universities, and to the younger half of our population. Unfortunately, the ideas are new to them, but they resound inside them because they're true. They're thirsty for it. There's a lot of empirical support for this belief that man is intrinsically evil. We only have to look at the 20th century, at the Nazis. I'm going to cite 2 books whose subject is the Nazis. The first one is this, Ordinary Man, subtitled Reserve Police Battalion 101 and the Final Solution in Poland. And it's a shocking account of how a unit of average middle-aged Germans became the cold-blooded murderers of tens of thousands of Jews. How would that happen? This Reserve Police Battalion 101 was responsible for mass shootings as well as roundup of Jewish people for deportation to Nazi death camps in Poland, 1942. The author documents that most of the men of 101 were not fanatical Nazis, but rather ordinary middle-aged working-class men who committed these atrocities out of a mixture of motives, including the group dynamics of conformity, deference to authority, role adaptation, and the altering of moral norms to justify their actions. Very quickly, 3 groups emerged within the battalion. The first was a corps of eager killers. Second was a plurality, most of them, who carried out their duties reliably, but without initiative. And there was a third group, a small minority, who evaded participation in the acts of killing, without diminishing the murderous efficiency of the battalion whatsoever. The general argument is made that most people succumb to the pressures of a group setting and commit actions they would never do of their own volition. The second book I want to mention is this, a very famous one, by Hannah Arendt. It's called Eichmann in Jerusalem, A Report on the Banality of Evil, a wonderful phrase. Adolf Eichmann was a German Nazi SS officer and lieutenant colonel, and he was one of the major organizers of the Holocaust. And he was tasked by the SS to managing the logistics involved in the mass deportation of Jews to ghettos and extermination camps. After the war, he was put on trial in Israel. He was interrogated every day for months. He wouldn't admit anything. Finally, he was presented with so much evidence, he did admit he was lying. Then Eichmann insisted he had no authority in the Nazi hierarchy and was only following orders. He asked for pardon. He was quoted as saying, "There's a need to draw a line between the leaders responsible and the people like me forced to serve as mere instruments in the hands of the leaders. I was not a responsible leader, and as such, do not feel myself guilty." But he managed the logistics for the extermination of millions. It's a kind of moral blindness. Well, Hannah Arendt, in her book, Eichmann in Jerusalem, explained that she got to know him and be in touch with him and interview him. And she was shocked. She expected some sort of moral monster. What she found was a perfectly ordinary man, just like the men in the police unit 101. Average middle-class man, not particularly evil at all. And yet, look what he had done. How could this have come from such an ordinary man? It's the banality of it, the ever-awareness of it, the commonness of it. The commonness of evil is the banality of evil, in her phrase, in her famous phrase. Explains out Heinrich Himmler, who was a responsible leader, actually, is the head of the feared SS. Himmler supervised the extermination of millions. He was an ordinary boy, grew into an obsessive and superstitious man who ventured into herbalism, astrology, and homeopathic medicine before finally turning to the false science of racial purity. So Hannah Arendt explains how Himmler was able to twist the logic of morality to assuage the conscience of the handpicked, academically degreed leaders. The commanders of the Einsatzgruppen were among the intellectual elite of this secret service, the SS. What this says about the ability of the academic degree to see through the sophistry to the evil is very interesting. So much for education being the path to moral excellence. Well, it seems to be that often intellectuals are more easily deluded because the power of their mind can fool their mind with magnificent delusions. The author points out that, for the most part, the members of the SS were not murderers or sadists by nature. There just weren't enough murderers or sadists around to perpetuate such monstrous evil on so gigantic a scale. And the Germans actually made a systematic effort to weed out the psychopaths under the understanding that soldiers are not killers, that killers do not make good soldiers. Himmler's problem was how to overcome the ordinary human feeling of pity that a normal person feels in the presence of physical suffering. He was able to turn this normal, instinctual feeling around. Instead of saying to oneself, "What horrible things I did to people," his men came instead to this perspective. "What a horrible things I had to watch in the pursuance of my duties. How heavily the task weighs upon my shoulders." In other words, pity for the suffering is turned into self-pity, egotism in its most basic and vain form. "What horrible things I had to watch." The failure to put suffering in the proper perspective against the greater setting of human history and the cold, striking tragedies of the world. The SS men were now the victims because they had to witness the suffering in the performance of their sacred duties. From here, it was but a small step to hate the Jews for thrusting the unwanted and distasteful work upon upright and just men of duty. The SS men were thus able to stay convinced of their own civilized nature. They felt there was no descent into barbarism under this formulation. What idea could be more twisted than that? This logic was important for Eichmann because at all times Eichmann was doing his duty in accordance with the law. In doing so, he was fulfilling his moral duty while satisfying his psychological need for authority. He was a man who was narrow-minded enough to take his job seriously and avoid the temptation of interpreting, amending, or exceeding the orders. To him, to do so would have been unlawful. He avoided being criminal by following the orders of the law, never understanding that the regime pronouncing the law was itself criminal. He was in a contorted world where orders that were contrary to those issued by the criminal regime were considered criminal. A world of legal crimes. He couldn't see the self-canceling nature of criminal laws enacted by a criminal state and make the moral judgments for himself. In just these sorts of cases where human judgment is paramount, where there's no longer any rules or principles or cultural values to guide one's judgment. To exercise judgment under conditions of uncertainty is just what it means to be human. Where does this ability to judge based on inner consciousness in the face of contrary cultural values and social societies come from? Well, apparently not from education. Practically all the men in this group were very well educated, very smart. Hannah Arendt felt that totalitarianism was a new and unrepresented form, was a new form of government that came into existence in the 20th century. It was a massive intrusion of criminal violence into the realm of politics, a vast bureaucracy. It was the rule by nobody. How readily can we expect one to think originally and judge independently in a set of never-before-encountered social and cultural rules with no precedent? I'm talking about totalitarianism. Now, to return to Jordan Peterson, what he had to say about this in one of his lectures was, he was addressing about 3,000 students. He said, "Let's admit it," talking to college students. "How many Schindlers were there saving Jews out of a group of 3,000 like you? Maybe five? All the rest of you would have been like the police unit 101. you would have gone along with it, with the extermination and the death camps. You probably think I'm wrong, but the record shows that it's people just like you and me that are capable of such evil. So, friends, that's enough about Peterson today. Enough for one podcast. If I'm true to my plans, I'm going to return to the subject in the next podcast and talk about its relationship to the Eucharist and to Christ's body in the Adoration Chapel and see how all these things are connected. But that's enough for one podcast. Here on Setting the Record Straight, we've examined the crooked record of mankind ever since the fall of Adam. I know this is hard. It's hard to face the snake in ourselves. But that's one of the most important aspects of Catholicism. After doing that, we could reconcile ourselves with God in the confessional. On breadboxmedia.com, this is Chuck Coughlin. God's grace on you all.
Redbox Media programming is brought to you by...
We want to help others, especially in places of strife, such as the Holy Land, where Christianity is dwindling by the day. But how to help? Here's an easy way. Buying products through the Holy Land gift shop. Every product you purchase at myfranciscan.org/shop helps Christians support their families and stay in the Holy Land. Olive wood, embroidery, spices, and many more authentic products from the Holy Land are available right now at myfranciscan.org/shop. The Holy Land Gift Shop, bringing the Holy Land home.
I learned how many people we could help and how good you feel after you've helped others.
I know Lent is about giving, so I want to give.
These kids are talking about CRS Rice Bowl, a Lenten program known by generations of Catholic families. Children love it because they experience different cultures and gain a lasting impression of the people they are helping. You can bring CRS Rice Bowl into your home and experience the joy of seeing your children or grandchildren find new meaning in Lent. Visit crsricebowl.org to get started.
Rice Bowl inspired me to pray more and to pray for those who are less fortunate.
The Cincinnati Catholic Men's Conference is back. Tickets are on sale now for Saturday, April 28th at the Taft Theater at cincinnatimensconference.com or call 513-214-1534. The speaker conference roster is being hailed as one of the best lineups in the country. In rare appearances, come see Father Mitch Pacwa from EWTN, the man motivator Father Larry Richards, former Moeller High School and University of Notre Dame head football coach Jerry Faust, and the big celebrity keynote, Baz Rutten, UFC world champion, MMA world champ, and movie star. The conference theme is What It Means to Be a True Christian Man in Today's Society. Don't miss the incredible day of motivation, spiritual benefit, and fellowship with men from all walks of life. Get tickets now at cincinnatimensconference.com or call 513-214-1534. That's cincinnatimensconference.com or 513-214-1534. Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media. Find more about us at breadboxmedia.com.